Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Vital Times, the podcast from the California Society of Anesthesiologists. I'm your host, Ron George, from the University of California, San Francisco. This episode, we'll be speaking with Dr. Gina Sinsky, who is the Vice Chair for the ASA Committee on Physician Well-Being and an Associate Professor and Associate Chair of Well-Being for the Department of Anesthesia and Perioperative Care here at UCSF. During our discussion, I hope Dr. Sinsky will share with us her vision for a sustainable culture of support to foster physician well-being. Hi, Gina. And first, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your career path and how physician well-being has become such an important topic for you.
Hi, Ron. It's such an honor to be here today. And thank you so much for the invitation and the great introduction. So I actually started thinking about well-being shortly after residency. As a resident, you know, I felt that I was really tough and resilient, and I didn't need any of this well-being stuff. And then I became involved in a malpractice suit. And during that time, I really struggled with feelings of guilt and anger and kind of really loss in confidence in my ability to practice anesthesia. And then one morning, I was actually a fellow at Boston Children's at the time. I attended a morning grand rounds on the second victim phenomenon after adverse events. And it made me realize that the emotions that I were feeling were actually a very normal reaction to an abnormal event. And so when I returned to UCSF as an attending, I really wanted to teach our residents about the second victim phenomenon, as well as other important issues around well-being. And this led to my being becoming the Associate Director of Residency Well-Being for UCSF. And as I learned more about well-being issues, I then realized that in order for residents to be well, faculty have to be well. Faculty well-being very much drives residency well-being and the culture of the organization. So this then led to my involvement in faculty well-being. And in 2020, I was appointed as Associate Chair of the Department for Well-Being. As you said, I've also been involved in national efforts to enhance well-being because I feel that national policies serve as the backbone of well-being issues.
That's great. Is physician wellness new to medicine, or why does it feel like we are just rediscovering this and it's important to physicians?
You bring up a great point. Well-being has always been an issue, but historically, there's been a huge stigma in medicine against admitting that you're burnt out or need help. It's seen as a sign of weakness. And in addition to stigma, there are very real consequences to talking about mental health issues, because there are structural issues such as medical licensure that are huge barriers to seeking mental health support. In one study, nearly 40% of physicians in the US stated that they would be reluctant to seek formal medical care for a mental health condition due to concerns about medical licensure. And this is actually an active area of national advocacy. The Federation of State Medical Boards has published recommendations in 2018 for physician well-being for medical license applications. For example, questions should focus only on current impairment due to mental health conditions. However, a recent review showed that only one state out of 50 was consistent with all five recommendations.
Wow. As I mentioned in the introduction, you are the vice chair for the ASA Committee on Physician Well-Being. How is the American Society of Anesthesiologists tackling this concerning area of interest?
So as you mentioned, there's a Standing Committee on Physician Well-Being within the ASA, and there are four working groups of the committee. Number one is ASA Outreach, where we really try to get members involved and also inform members about the well-being resources available. There's also a group on systems and policy impacting well-being, mental health and suicide prevention, and as well as education and endeavors. And the working groups are actually open to all ASA members, regardless of committee membership status. So if you're interested, definitely reach out and let me know. And the ASA has actually released a statement on creating a culture of well-being for healthcare workers. And this includes some very specific recommendations for organizations to be able to support well-being of anesthesiologists. And this statement was unanimously approved by the ASA House of Delegates in October of 2021. And this statement and other well-being resources can be found on the ASA well-being webpage.
Great. I'm looking forward to kind of looking more in depth into the ASA's webpage on well-being and gaining some more insight. You know, the past 2.5 years have been very challenging for anyone in healthcare. How has the COVID-19 pandemic shifted or perhaps uncovered what we know about physician burnout and physician well-being?
I think one thing that the COVID-19 pandemic has done is that people are much more willing to talk about burnout and well-being. I think before the COVID pandemic, people were very unwilling to talk about their own burnout and their own lack of well-being. And as we're experiencing, you know, at the risk of sounding very cliche, this unprecedented event, and as the COVID-19 pandemic wears on, I feel that people are much more willing to talk about it. And a lot of these issues are not new. They are issues that were already there, and the COVID-19 pandemic has only exacerbated those existing issues. In fact, a recent Medscape survey actually asked physicians, you know, when did your well-being start? Was it before or during the COVID pandemic? And 80% or 4 out of 5 of them said that it had started before the pandemic.
Very interesting. Gina, I've had an opportunity to read a number of your publications. And one of your more recent publications on this topic, entitled The Wicked Problem of Physician Wellbeing, great title, by the way, published recently in Anesthesiology Clinics. In this, you provide a framework for a shift to a more sustainable culture of well-being for physicians. I want you, maybe you could take some time and share with us and share with the listeners your vision for this sustainable culture that you outlined in this article.
Absolutely. So the term wicked problem, it was actually a term that I believe was first described in either urban planning or policy. And it refers to a problem that is impossible or difficult to solve because there are many factors and layers that are involved. In a way, once you uncover an issue of your wicked problem, there's a deeper, more difficult issue beneath it. So I think of wicked problems as being opposed to tame problems. So tame problems, for example, would be like a simple arithmetic problem. You know the answer, you just need to find that answer. But with wicked problems, you don't even know if there's an answer. So in terms of a framework for us to be able to shift to a more sustainable culture, we made some recommendations in that paper, and I want to thank my co-authors, Dr. Rebecca Margolis and Amy Vinson. Dr. Amy Vinson is actually the chair of the Committee on Physician Wellbeing and is very much aligned in the thinking that both individual and systems approaches are required to adequately approach physician wellbeing. So we had 5 different recommendations there. And I'll go through each of them. The number one recommendation we had was to really stop the glorification of excessive self-sacrifice. What do I mean by that? Well, there's been a culture in medicine of, you know, even when you're really ill, you go and take care of your patients. And I think just with the COVID pandemic, we've kind of realized that maybe that's not the best idea. And that's why a lot of us do stay home when we're ill. And often you've probably heard this adage, you know, you should put on your oxygen mask first before you put it on others. And so I think it's really important to fill your cup first and make sure that you're not pouring from an empty cup. The next thing, going back to what I said about malpractice lawsuits, it's really important to stop blaming and shaming doctors. Oftentimes, you know, everyone's trying to do their best, trying to take the best care of their patient. And when there is this constant fear that you're going to be, you know, named in a malpractice suit, et cetera, it really leads to difficulty with taking the best care of your patient, but also this sense of non-well-being where you're constantly, you know, living in this fear. The next thing is really to normalize peer and mental health support. As I said earlier, there's a huge stigma against it that exists. There's been a lot of work being done, especially since the COVID-19 pandemic, to really normalize, you know, asking for and receiving help. And so I think it's really important. We, for example, at UCSF have a very robust peer supporter program called Caring for the Caregiver. And I think many other programs around the country have this as well. And I think it's okay to ask for help. It's actually a sign of strength when you do ask for help and when you're vulnerable. The next one is really It's called Stop the Strip Mining. And this was actually brought up in a, I want to say like a working session at UCSF with other departments, in the term Stop the Strip Mining. And it's really kind of reflecting the current state of medicine, where as time goes on, we're being asked to do more with less. And I think that is never more true than now during the COVID-19 pandemic, especially with the most recent surge. There's a lot of short staffing, and yet, you know, there's clinical expansion going on, and physicians are really asked to be doing a lot more with less resources, less staffing, and I think that is something that we really need to work on and be able to improve. Finally, we want to empower physicians to be the architects of their own environment. Physicians, you know, who are on the front lines definitely know exactly what's going on the front lines and are able to really come up with solutions that meet those needs while being also very feasible and also viable. So I feel like it's important to have physicians, frontline physicians on your team to be able to enact those changes.
Yeah, in reading your article, I was really touched by, you know, you have a quote there from David Chestnut, who speaks to sort of those attributes of kindness and altruism, and something that he has always done so well at putting forward in as his mentoring role, and a hero of mine. So I was glad to see that. With this role that you've taken on at your department, I mean, has this led to you know more and more people coming up to you in the hallways and sort of being their almost, you know, social worker in terms of dealing with well-being issues? And how do you deal with that aspect of it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I work very clinically, and I think a very important part of being a well-being champion is being accessible and approachable, and that I think it's very good that people are able to approach me, you know, day to day and ask me about issues. And I think it's very important in terms of communication for there to be two-way communication. I'm able to really take things from frontline clinicians up to the leadership, but also bring things from the leadership back to the frontline clinicians. And so I think that, you know, that is definitely something that I take much pride in, and I think is a very important part of my job as associate chair of well-being.
And I can speak firsthand. It's always great having you around and having you so accessible in these more challenging times, of course. The theory of well-being seems like a bit of a no-brainer. You know, who doesn't want their physicians, or in our case, our colleagues, to feel valued and not to have their careers be a burden on the quality of life? What sort of supports or framework can you help our listeners achieve in their own practices?
So that's a great question. At UCSF, we've actually developed a step-by-step approach to operationalizing well-being. And we call this approach QALY, or quality of life improvement. And the QALY approach incorporates elements of human-centered design, also known as design thinking, quality improvement, and implementation science. And we incorporate two frameworks when we think about the organization of well-being. These are the areas of work life. They've been they were proposed by Drs. Maslach and Leiter, and they really refer to areas in your work life where, when your values, your individual values, and the organization's values are mismatched, that leads to burnout. And the other framework is a modified Maslow's hierarchy of needs. This means that there's a hierarchy of needs, starting with, you know, the basics in terms of mental health, food, sleep, bathroom, leading up to safety, and all the way up to self-actualization, which in the case of physicians is the ability to take good care of your patients. So the thing about QALY is that it has three different phases. The first phase really focuses on defining your problem. You need to build a team, you need to perform internal and external assessments, and then finally take the time to define what your problem is. Because as I said, with the wicked problem of physician well-being, it's really hard to define. And once you define that problem, it takes you one step closer to being able to solve it. Now, phase two is really focused on potential solutions. So you try to brainstorm solutions, then you prioritize them and get them ready for testing. So prioritizing is a key step, because a lot of time, you know, when I speak with department leaders and leaders of other organizations, they're asking me, where's the biggest bang for my buck? You know, where should I be investing? Where's the highest return on investment? And so we have two ways of prioritizing this. Number one is what I call the sweet spot. And you have to meet these three criteria. It has to be desirable. You don't want to do something that people don't want. Next, it has to be feasible. If it's not achievable, like if it's not doable, then you know, you're not wasting your time. And then number three, it needs to be viable. It does need to make business sense at the end of the day. We don't have unlimited resources. And the second way we prioritize is actually very much borrowed for quality improvement. It's called the PIC chart. And it really looks at the difficulty of implementing something versus the payoff. And using those two, you're able to prioritize. So going back to phase three of QALY, that's really where you want to do a PDSA cycle. PDSA stands for Plan, Do, Study, Act, and it's a very active part of quality improvement. So you want to test your idea, and then you want to evaluate whether that testing worked in robust ways. You know, you want to define your outcome measures ahead of time. And then finally, you need to iterate. There are constant threats to well-being. The first several rounds of QALY were performed before the COVID-19 pandemic. And as you can imagine, there have been multiple threats to well-being since then. For example, at the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, when there were elective cases that were canceled and there was really low surgical volume, people were very worried about the lack of work. And that seems like such a distant history when you think about what's going on now, where we have an overabundance of work and short staffing. And this has become an issue where the pendulum has swung multiple ways. So it's important to be able to have a very facile way to look at this. And I feel like the QALY approach allows us to do that. And we've recently published this work using the two frameworks and QALY in anesthesiology clinics. And I'm happy to discuss this further with any of the listeners out there.
Well, what's the key to keeping these frameworks going, however? You know, it's one thing to have a great idea and look at it. How do we keep our administrative aspect of our jobs and our leadership engaged in this topic?
I think that is the key question for well-being at this moment. You know, there's definitely, you know, you can say as much as you want about well-being, but unless it translates to action, it's really, really difficult. And I think, you know, in some ways, a very important part is to think about the business side of why it's important to invest in physician well-being. For example, there's a business case out there in terms of an article that was written several years ago, and they estimate the cost of replacing one physician at $500,000 to $1 million. So if you think about that, it is very wise, even financially, to be investing in well-being. And if you can emphasize that with your leadership, I think that goes a long way. The AMA actually has a burnout calculator where you can calculate the cost of burnout in your own organization, as well as the return on investment by seeing how much is your return based on the amount of money you invest. So I think those are some realistic ways in which you can convince your organization and your leadership to make that investment.
Thanks, Gina. And I'll attest to our listeners, I think you should take time to look up some of Dr. Sinsky's recent publications where they provide an excellent framework for many of these issues and questions that you're going to have. You know, we hope we have many listeners that are in medical school, residency, or even early career anesthesiologists. And, you know, you've told us a little bit about how your path has been, was set in front of you. What advice might you give to some of our younger members in the medical community considering a similar career path to your own and perhaps taking a specific interest in physician wellness?
So I'm going to share some advice that I received very early on and as a resident, and it served me well. And I think it would serve anybody well, even those who are not specifically interested in well-being. So there are two things. Number one, show up. And number two, follow through. So it's really important to be involved early on in these efforts. You might think that, oh, I'm just a medical student. Oh, I'm just a resident. But no, you're the future of medicine. So it's really important that you participate in this and help drive the changes, because this will affect you for decades. And it's very important that also when you sign up for something, you know, you raise your hand, you need to follow through. It's kind of shocking at how rarely people follow through. And so if you can do that, you can actually set yourself apart from a lot of other people. And a lot of opportunities come from showing up and doing a good job. And then someone else sees you and is willing to sponsor you for the next opportunity. And specifically for well-being, I think a great first step is to become involved in your own, you know, organization, whether it's medical school or residency, in driving well-being. And also another way to do this is to become involved in the working groups that I mentioned earlier of the ASA Committee on Physician Well-being. All you have to do is email myself or Dr. Amy Vinson, and we're happy to get you involved in any of the four working groups. So those are some specific ways to be involved in well-being.
That's great advice, and I hope some students take you up on that, because I know yourself or Amy will be great mentors and future sponsors for those individuals. Thanks so much. Now, before we finish off, I'm going to end with some rapid-fire questions, which I'm going to call code anesthesia. And this is meant to be a little bit fun, Gina.
That's good. This sounds awesome. I'm very excited for this.
I just want your gut instinct. I'm going to give you a couple of two options, and I want you to let me know your choice, and you have to choose one. There's no compromising here.
Absolutely. I'm ready.
And I've tried to pick some of these that are more poignant to your area in pediatric anesthesia as well. All right. Like I said, just give me your gut instinct.
Sounds good.
Inhalational versus IV induction.
IV induction all the way.
Interesting.
All the way. And IV is a gift. If I get an IV that works, it is an absolute gift to me.
That's perfect. Perfect. Midazolam versus dexmedetomidine.
I love dexmedetomidine. It's my third favorite drug. First is propofol, second is epinephrine, and then third is dexmedetomidine.
The fact that you have a list is, I know I've got the right person for the podcast. This is great. Sevoflurane versus propofol.
Propofol. I love propofol. I mean, I just told you, it's my number one favorite drug.
Kaleidoscope versus CMAC.
CMAC, especially if you're dealing with a child that's under 10 kilos, there's great work done on this. You want to use a non-hyperangulated blade.
Excellent. I did not know that. Great. I'm learning stuff here. Deep versus awake extubation.
That, I have to say, depends, but most of the time I prefer deep.
Okay, great. Remember, I said no compromising. Yes. And lastly, Miller versus McIntosh.
You know, I'm a pediatric anesthesiologist, right? I mean, McIntosh, come on. I absolutely prefer the Miller blade. And my favorite blade is the Wiss Hipple 1.5. So that's out there.
Oh, you're hitting it at home here. I love the Wiss Hipple. I was a big fan of that in my residency.
It's amazing. It's like the one, if I could have one, it's not the Mach 3 blade. It's the Wiss 1.5.
So. Okay. That's the one you would take to a deserted island if only you could have one piece of anesthesia equipment.
Absolutely. It might be difficult to intubate an adult with that, but yes, I would take that.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Gina. This concludes yet another episode of Vital Times, the podcast. And I'm Ron George, and it's been great talking to our guest, Dr. Gina Sinsky. And I'd like to thank you all for listening. Good night.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great, Ron, and I had a lot of fun.